So friends, I am going to do something that I don't think I've ever done. I'm going to read somebody else's sermon. And it's by a colleague, Orthodox colleague, Mitchell Wahlberg, who's out of Baltimore, Maryland. And I had the advantage, the opportunity to learn from him several times. I'm a member of the New York Board of Rabbis, and around the high holiday season, in August, September, they'd always have a number of top darshanim who would come and present. And this is 3 hours earlier. I guess he finished it there, but he always gets these out around Wednesday. And I like this. I thought it's a really nice drash. We'll talk about it afterwards. I think I'll be able to read it fast enough so we can have a conversation about the content afterwards. And it's entitled Wahlberg's Man of the Year. Although Time magazine is no longer the powerhouse it was in the 20th century, its annual selection of the Person of the Year still becomes a topic of conversation. This year, the choice was Jamal Khashoggi and other journalists who gave their lives to help the world know the truth. The choice was certainly worthwhile, but I would have to say the Time magazine's description of what goes into its choice for Person of the Year as being the person who, for better or for worse, has done the most to influence the events of the year, I think there is someone much more fitting of that description. What this man has done almost defies description. Amongst other things, it is said that he has dismantled the Soviet Union, destroyed the Malaysian economy, organized the Women's March, made possible the NFL National Anthem protests, controls the State Department, is financing a purple revolution, attempting to break up the Eurozone, has launched coups in four Eastern European countries, is destroying Facebook, and while we're at it, was behind the neo-Nazi march in Charlottesville, and finally, he is the Antichrist. It's not bad for one person. In fact, doing all this would make this person not just the man of the year, but the person of all time. And his name is George Soros. Hungarian-born George Soros, at the age of 88, has given away at least $32 billion to charities. Since the 1980s, most of that money has gone to groups that build democracy and civic institutions, particularly in his native Eastern Europe. His Open Society Foundation operates in about 100 countries, and the list that I mentioned of the things he is accused of doing just begins to scratch the surface of the lies and false accusations that have been hurled at this man, a man The Economist magazine labeled the making of a boogeyman, and whom Dana Milbrank in the Washington Post headlined, "Of course it's George Soros's fault. It's always George Soros's fault." Perhaps with this in mind, the website dictionary.com chose as its word of the year misinformation, the spreading of false information. There's almost nothing that happened this year that some commentator, website, or official didn't blame on George Soros. Now, it's one thing when Russia's Vladimir Putin accuses him of trying to dominate the world, and it's one thing when Turkey's President Erdogan accuses him of trying to undermine the Turkish government. And it's one thing when the leader of Soros' native country, Hungary, based his entire election campaign, which was labeled Stop Soros, by saying that Soros was crafty, international, and feel he owns the world. These three are rotten autocrats who most intelligent people denounce for their behavior. But it's quite a different story when the president of the U.S. and his son say they wouldn't be surprised if Soros funded the caravan of Central American migrants and suggest he might have been behind the Brett Kavanaugh protests. We're now stepping into dangerous territory because everyone knows that George Soros is a Jew. George Soros is our generation's Rothschild, the Jewish globalist who controls the world. That kind of misinformation has had tragic consequences in the past and right up to the present day. Cesar Sayoc, who sent the 13 pipe bombs in an attempt to assassinate critics of Donald Trump, sent the first one to George Soros. and was friends with a Facebook group entitled Kill George Soros. And Robert Bowers, the Pittsburgh synagogue mass murderer, brought into the Soros caravan conspiracy, and his website showed a fake picture of Honduran immigrants getting into a truck with a Magen David on its side. Misinformation can kill. Now, before the Trump supporters walk out on me, let me make two things crystal clear, he writes. First, the problem of misinformation is not simply coming from the right, it is equally threatening from the left. Last month, the New York Times Book Review, in an interview with writer Alice Walker, who is known to be a fan of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, and who recently wrote poems proclaiming the Talmud as a source of evil, listed as a book that she was reading and encouraged people to read as a book by David Icke. And Icke's book was so anti-Semitic that his publisher refused to publish it, and he had to print it himself. He holds Jews responsible for the Russian Revolution, both world wars, and much of the Holocaust. And he bases much of his book on the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a notorious anti-Semitic piece of junk, denies the Holocaust, and just to make sure that no one should doubt that he's off his rocker, Icke claims that reptilians from an alien race control the world. This is who the New York Times, the paper of record, presents to the American people without comment, and that's also misinformation. Let me give you one more bit of real information. Don't let anyone here leave today believing Mitchell Wahlberg, think well of George Soros. It was in September 2010 that I delivered a sermon entitled Soros with Soros. You've got to admit, that's creative. In which I pointed out that here is this billionaire Jew who not only does not lend his support to most any Jewish cause, but quite the contrary, has supported with hundreds of millions of dollars organizations which are highly anti-Semitic, and which even one of their founders, Robert Bernstein, resigned from because it's so biased against the one Jewish state. I don't care about Soros. I care about us. I care about the Jewish people. I care about the American people. I care that in a world of so much misinformation, we have gotten so used to it that we're starting to accept it. That's the same mistake the Jews made in Egypt. Our Torah portion tells us of God's promise to redeem the Jewish people. God said to Moshe, I am the Lord, and I will take you mitachat siblot Mitzrayim, from under the suffering of the Egyptians. The Kotzker Rebbe, however, read this verse, mitachat siblot Mitzrayim, from under the yoke and suffering of the Egyptians, a bit different. Siblot, which we translate here as suffering, can also have another meaning. It comes from the word soval, meaning patient, tolerant, enduring. The Jews had to be taken out from the mindset they had developed in Egypt, a mindset of being able to take it, to be patient, a mindset of, oh, well, it's not so bad. As bad as it is, we can manage it. Who knows if it's any better out there? Let's just continue as things are here. Indeed, our sages, in a rather remarkable commentary, tell us, Lo barach me'enam eved Mitzrayim, no Jewish slave ever escaped out of Egypt. Now, on a simple level, this is telling us that the Egyptians had established a powerful security system that made escape impossible. But on a deeper level, it means that none of the Jews ever attempted to escape. After a while, they developed the attitude that it's not so bad here. Better the devil I know than the one I may have to meet and adjust to. The danger is that we as Americans and experiencing a society where misinformation has become so prevalent will start to lose sight of things and start to think that it really doesn't make a difference. We'll get so used to it that it will become accepted and tolerated behavior. We won't bother to differentiate between truth and falsehood. This is becoming the new normal. We must remember that this is 2019 and not Orwell's 1984. Words have tremendous power. we must strive to remain informed, not misinformed. You may say that what is happening in the media and in politics is beyond our control, and to some degree that may be true. So perhaps for this coming new year, the best advice I can give you is to remember the story told by Reb Nachman of Bratslav. The great Hasidic master was also a great Hasidic storyteller, and one of his stories, which I love, is entitled The Tainted Grain, and it goes like this. The king's stargazer saw that the grain harvested that year was tainted. Anyone who would eat from it would become insane. What can we do, said the king? It's not possible to destroy the crop, for we do not have enough grain stored to feed the entire population. Perhaps, said the stargazer, we should set aside enough grain for ourselves. At least that way we would maintain our sanity. The king replied, if we do that, we'll be considered insane. If everyone behaves one way and we behave differently, we'll be considered the not normal ones. Rather, said the king, I suggest that we too eat from the crop like everyone else. However, to remind ourselves that we are not normal, we'll make a mark on our forehead. Even if we are insane, whenever we look at each other, we will remember that we are insane. Let me just amend Reb Nachman's words. It's not we who are insane. It's the world that has gone crazy. This is not normal. A world with false news, conspiracy theories, trolls, hacking, Russian interference, memes. Woe unto us that we are living in a world where we can't even trust the National Enquirer. So who can you trust in this new year? One thing is for sure, you can't trust what you read on the internet. Listen to these words from an article in New York Magazine. How much of the internet is fake? Studies generally suggest that year after year, less than 60% of web traffic is human. Some years, according to some researchers, a healthy majority of it is bot. For a period of time in 2013, The Times reported this year, a full half of YouTube traffic was bots masquerading as people. Fake people with fake cookies and fake social media accounts, fake moving their fake cursors, fake clicking on fake websites. You have to trust your own instincts and not believe every article that is forwarded from friends. You have to check your own biases and make sure they don't blind you to reality. In the new year that now beckons, we have to have faith in ourselves, in our God, in our country, and in our people, in the hope that we will see the fulfillment of our people's New Year prayer. Tichle shana v'kilotecha, tachel shana uvechotecha. May the old year and its curses come to an end. May the new year and its blessings begin. Amen. So here's what I want to ask you. First of all, do you agree with Rabbi Wollenberg that fake news is a crisis that threatens the basis of a civil society founded on truth and discourse?
Yes.
Yes.
So we have a large number of consensus of the people who don't say anything, they're fake news, no. Here's a question for you, though. He says, trust our instincts. And I'm not really convinced that we can trust our instincts because they are so polluted by this society and this strange moment we find ourselves in. So the crowdsourced question for us is, how can we be a bulwark against misinformation? How can we, as part of a people and a culture that has relentlessly pursued the truth at all costs throughout the ages, that has developed a tremendous discourse of argumentation precisely because we believe in the pursuit of truth and in intellectual rigor, what can we do in our own communities and for ourselves against this scourge? Lee.
So, my feeling is that if you have knowledge that you
So I think one of the things Lee's talking about is there's a track record. I mean, Mark Twain famously said that the truth is still putting on its pants when a lie's already traveled halfway around the world. And Twain was right, except that the pants putting on truth ultimately tends to last and endure. Certainly the process of science, you can have adjustments to it, but over time a conservative, not intellectually, not politically, body of knowledge that has stood the test of time comes to be the basis against which new claims have to be adjudicated. Wonderful.
So this is something that I talk about a lot. I'm a librarian at a college, and I talk a lot with students about where they get information and how they can figure out what's real, what they can use as evidence. There are actually some techniques that we get from the discipline of fact-checking. Those people who used to work for newspapers and magazines and check the facts before they went into print, they have some simple steps, and I'll forward some stuff to the rabbi after Shabbos, but it involves checking where the information came from. If there's a link that says a study showed, what study? Who did it? The next question is, what do other people think? Has somebody already checked this out? And there are websites you can check that honestly just list all of the fake stories that have been sent to them that they've checked and either found a valid source or found that there's not a valid source. And some of us have been sending these sites like Snopes.com around since it was email forwarding that was the problem. But there are ways that you can check a little bit further without doing hours of work. So 5 minutes of checking before you share that post and send that meme along can save a lot of trouble. And reminding people, reminding your friends to check this out, reminding them how.
Excellent. A little bit of we have a little bit of homework.
Hi, I'm a visitor, but I would say that I've...
What's your name, visitor?
Justin Topolo. From Los Angeles. And I've read a number of these things which show that when people see information that does not validate their point of view, that in fact they use it sort of against. In other words, even though it's something that refutes what they think and there are facts behind it, they refuse to accept it, right? And it only strengthens their point. So my point was to keep an open mind so that you don't become one of those people who sees facts that refute your already thinking, and you can say, oh, yes, maybe there is more to it.
Beautiful. Yeah, it actually, those things that contradict strengthen the belief people are always in. And I've actually had people sometimes when what's happening on the American scene seems so bad, and they're like, Rabbi, why didn't you speak up against it? And sometimes I say, because the people who already agree with how I might interpret it aren't going to be changed, and the people who disagree aren't going to be changed, and I'm actually going to strengthen the opposite belief from truth, and that's something I'm unwilling to do.
Just about skepticism. Being skeptical is unfortunately something that I've had to live with for a while now with news. And well before the last, I don't know, 3 years or so in terms of fake news. I remember years ago in the Second Intifada, seeing these terrible images, this happening and this riot happening. And then I remember watching it from beginning to end going, wait a minute, why was the camera there before the Israeli soldiers were there? Things like that. Like, how did this happen? How come they're in the most violent part of it and they're okay? How did that happen? So it's not, you know, you can disagree with what's happening, but you having that perspective and going, wait a minute, what am I actually seeing here? And on that very same note, years ago in Montreal, there was a televised arrest of a rabbi who was gun smuggling. He was a rabbi of no congregation. I don't know what, you know, he just happened to have had a smicha. But big television stations knew all about it before anyone else did, and they were there for the arrest as well. Again, how'd that happen? Why did that happen? Or what's the motive here? So just being skeptical.
I want to tie in with that notion of skepticism. One of our challenges in our age is that our society moves so quickly and that we are so easily agitated that we are unwilling to wait. And I think even you get an email that people expect to answer right away, well, you don't think very well quickly. Sometimes if you just say, thanks, I got your email, you raised some interesting points, let me think about it, so that their agita about not being answered is addressed, gives us time maybe to restore thought.
Thank you. I just wanted to share that I'm doing that as well with my kids, from telling the 9-year-old, you know, look at that video of those dudes doing amazing things and think about how it's staged and not real, to my 15-year-old this morning asking me this topic. So he said, what do the Russians gain from spreading all this disinformation? And I had to try to explain to him the idea that if you eliminate people's ability to trust what they see in the news, we have to rely on first impressions, on pre-existing biases, that we can't figure out what to do now because we can't trust the information that's coming in to base a rational decision on.
So it's,
And people around, too. There are people at the synagogue I've talked to about, I hear that Canada is now welcoming in people who work with Hamas. Where did you hear that? This Christian broadcast. Let's check that. No, I don't see anything on them, a quick search. Can you go back and send me a link to that so we can check that further?
So I think you bring something up. Many of us know that if we hear jokes that are demeaning of a group, whether that's Jews or blacks or lesbians or transgender or whatever it may be, that we have an obligation not to just let that hang in the air, because it tends to increase hatred, and we are always the canary in the coal mine. If only for self-interest, you should be against that, if not just for that it's right to stand up to that. But when we hear outrageous claims, maybe we do have an obligation to actually call people on it in a gentle, in a loving way, in a way that draws them in, hopefully, so that they have to justify it rather than showing them something which will only confirm what they already know. We'll take maybe one more.
There's a motto I live by, follow the money. Basically, it works for any argument. I always ask myself, who's benefiting? And that doesn't mean it's right or wrong or fake or real, but what are they trying to convince me of and why and who's benefiting? And if I always ask those questions, no matter who's making the argument or what the argument is, nonpartisanly, I get a much better picture of what's going on.
Right, so we can even expand that a little bit beyond money, and it's just what is the person who's saying this, what's their advantage, what's their benefit from it, and that we read with a certain skepticism. I have in my office a wonderful etching that is just a traditionally Jewish guy with the long beard, and the title is simply The Skeptic. And I got that from my grandfather, and I think that's actually one of our Jewish traits, right? I mean, there's some bad things about that, but there's also in the realm of a world that looks like this, maybe that's also a trait. And as for following the money, I've always believed that in my life. That's why I work on Wall Street. Friends, we are going to continue now with Musaf, and I think, you know, prayers may sound in the realm of aspiration, but they do speak about certain deep truths that we don't have full control over our lives, under our environment, but that we call out and put out our needs there in the hopes that the world, the universe, is listening.